From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Members of the Commission, with your help, your staff has developed initial findings to present to the public on the coordination of national policy in dealing with the danger posed by Islamic extremist terrorism before the September 11th attacks on the United States.
Philip Zelikow, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, did he work to minimize the Bush administration's responsibility for failing to prevent the September 11th attacks? An explosive new book details Zelikow's close ties with both Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and President Bush's advisor, Karl Rove. We'll speak with New York Times investigative reporter Philip Shennan, author of The Commission, the uncensored history of the 9/11 investigation. But first, today is Super Tuesday. Voters in more than 20 states across the country heading to the polls in the biggest one-day White House nominating contest in history. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, the U.S. military has admitted to killing four family members and wounding another Monday in the Adwar village north of Baghdad. A couple and their 19-year-old son were instantly killed in the attack. The couple's two young daughters were injured. One of them later died in the hospital of her wounds, leaving her sister as the only survivor. A cousin who witnessed the killing said U.S. soldiers immediately opened fire after breaking into the home. The attack came 2 days after the U.S. admitted to killing 13 Iraqi civilians in an airstrike south of Baghdad. The dead included two women and an infant child. Another two children were wounded. Today marks the fifth anniversary of then-Secretary of State Colin Powell's speech before the U.N. Security Council making the case for attacking Iraq. Here in the United States, Super Tuesday has arrived. 24 states are up for grabs in what could be the decisive day in the race for the Republican and Democratic presidential nomination. Polls show Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in a dead heat in several states. Both Democratic candidates spent the day campaigning in the Northeast. Clinton addressed supporters in Massachusetts.
We're supposed to plant the trees that all of you will seek shade under. We're supposed to make sure that this country remains great and good. And there is no guarantee. There's no guarantee written in some book somewhere that America will remain the greatest nation in the world. It is up to us, each and every one of us, to make the decisions that will guarantee that comes true.
Obama, meanwhile, spoke in New Jersey at the Meadowlands, where he's narrowed Clinton's lead to a dead heat.
If you want to keep the dream alive for those who still hunger for justice and still thirst for opportunity, then I promise you this, we will not just win here in New Jersey, we will win all across this nation on Tuesday, we will win the nomination, we will win the general election, and you and I together, we will change this country and we will change the world.
Both the Clinton and Obama campaigns say they expect to race to extend into the primary contests in March and April. On the Republican side, Senator John McCain's leading national polls, but Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney is ahead in delegate-rich California. In other campaign news, new figures show the nuclear industry is shifting its donations to Democrats. The Los Angeles Times reports Democratic candidates received $830,000 from nuclear companies last year, compared to just under $300,000 for Republicans. Barack Obama was the highest recipient of nuclear money, followed by Hillary Clinton. Neither candidate has opposed lobbying efforts to expand reliance on nuclear power. Meanwhile, a new study of the type of health care plans offered by the Clinton and Obama campaigns argues Clinton's plan would cover more uninsured Americans. The health care economist Jonathan Gruber at MIT says a Clinton type of plan would cover 45 million uninsured at a cost of $124 billion. Obama's plan would cost less at $102 billion, but would only cover 23 million people. The plans differ on requiring Americans to buy insurance. The Clinton plan would make it mandatory, while the Obama plan would only require the purchase of insurance for children. Neither plan offers the single-payer system favored by a majority of Americans, according to public opinion polls. National Journal, meanwhile, has named Obama the most liberal senator of 2007. Obama got the number one ranking based on an analysis of 99 key Senate votes. Hillary Clinton was ranked at number 16 after placing 32nd in 2006. Overall, the two candidates differed on just 10 of the 267 measures they both voted on. President Bush unveiled his $3.1 trillion budget proposal Monday. The plan calls for major cuts to health spending while leaving a $400 billion deficit. The budget would extend Bush's tax cuts beyond their expiration date for 2011 at a cost of $635 billion.
That in order for this economy to grow, it's important to make the tax relief permanent. And that's what this budget reflects. It's a budget that boosts money for education and health and housing. It helps deal with the issue of making the tax code more fair for individuals who want to buy health insurance in the individual market.
The budget proposes spending cuts or freezes for most government agencies. The Homeland Security and Pentagon budgets would be among the few seeing increases, with the military getting a 7% boost. Including the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, U.S. military spending would reach at least $690 billion. The White House budget plan estimates the wars will cost $70 billion this year, a figure widely seen as far too low. Bush's plan would meanwhile cut billions from health care.
This budget is one that keeps spending under control. Discretionary spending is held to less than 1%. It eliminates 151 wasteful or bloated programs, saving the taxpayers $18 billion. It also takes a hard look at entitlement growth over the next 5 years.
The $208 billion cited by the president would come from deep cuts to Medicare and a freeze on new Medicaid spending. Among the other programs on the president's chopping block, food assistance for poor children and grants for career and technical education, community development, and revitalizing public housing. In Colombia, hundreds of thousands of people took part in a nationwide protest Monday against the rebel group FARC. The group is currently holding at least 800 hostages seized during its conflict with the Colombian government. Recently freed hostage Consuelo González de Perdomo was among the demonstrators.
I'm happy that the Colombian people have understood that they play an important role in the situation that this country is going through in trying to attain liberty, that this motivation has to continue and it has to be permanent.
Protests were also held across Latin America and in cities worldwide, including New York, Washington, Madrid, and Sydney. Two hostages were released last month, with another three expected this week. FARC says it will again hand over the hostages to Venezuela, where the president, Hugo Chavez, has called on the international community to revoke its labeling of FARC as a terrorist group and open negotiations on a peace deal. In Kenya, the Red Cross says the death toll from over a month of post-election violence has passed 1,000. Thousands more have been wounded, 300,000 displaced in clashes since President Mwai Kibaki beat opposition leader Raila Odinga in a widely disputed vote. Former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is in Kenya to hope broker a deal.
When these things begin, it's extremely difficult to bring it under control, but under control it must be brought under control. The government and the opposition and their representatives are here discussing the future of this country, discussing how we resolve these issues peacefully, and they've come up with measures that will help us get to where we want to be.
Talks resumed Monday after a UN-appointed mediator withdrew from the mediation. He was accused of business ties to Odinga. A new report from New Yorker correspondent Seymour Hersh says there's no evidence that the Syrian facility bombed by Israel last September was involved in nuclear weapons. Israel says it launched the attack based on intelligence of nuclear activity, but citing American, Israeli, and Syrian sources, Hersh says Israel did not know what it was targeting. Hersh says Israel's main objective was to send a message to Iran. The annual report from the Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 65 journalists were killed around the world last year, the most since 1994. Robert Mahoney of the CPJ says most of the killings were deliberate murders.
Well, it's one of the most dangerous years to be a journalist in well over a decade. We have documented 65 journalist deaths, and we have another 23 that we're still investigating. That's the highest since the wars in Rwanda and Algeria. And 75% of those journalists who were killed were deliberately murdered. They were targeted. They weren't caught in crossfire in a war. So it shows that being a journalist is an extremely dangerous profession these days.
32 journalists were killed in Iraq, matching the Iraq total from 2006. A civilian panel created to oversee government protection of personal privacy is now vacant after the terms of its remaining board members expired last month. The Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board had already been under scrutiny after one member resigned last year on accusations of White House censorship. The Bush administration has not submitted any new nominations. In California, an anti-military recruiting effort in the city of Berkeley is turning into a Senate battle over federal earmarks. Republican Senator Jim DeMint says he will introduce a measure to cut $0.3 million in federal spending for Berkeley from a Senate appropriations bill. $2.3 million. DeMint says he's responding to a series of resolutions from the Berkeley City Council in support of protests against the local Marine recruiting center. And the New York Times has revealed new information on the first Guantanamo Bay prisoner believed to have died of natural causes. Abdul Razak Hekmati died in December following a bout with cancer. U.S. forces arrested him in Afghanistan, where he was well known as a resistance fighter against the Soviet occupation of the 1980s. He was accused of being a Taliban commander and held for nearly 5 years at Guantanamo until his death. During his interrogation, Hekmati made several mentions of high-ranking Afghan officials who could have vouched for his innocence. These include Afghanistan's Minister of Energy and a high-ranking general who Hekmati freed in a daring jailbreak from the Taliban's top prison in 1999. But U.S. officials made little to no effort to contact them. The two men now say they made personal appeals to Afghan President Hamid Karzai and U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad with no result. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, it's Super Tuesday. Voters in more than 20 states across the country will head to the polls in the biggest one-day White House nominating contest in history. National polls show Senator John McCain leading the Republican race, but Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney's ahead in delegate-rich California. On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama locked in a dead heat with states awarding delegates proportionally. Instead of winner-take-all, both campaigns are telling supporters not to expect a clear winner after today's vote. For more, we go to Washington, D.C. On the line with Stephen Wayne, a professor of government at Georgetown University, has written over 10 books, including The Road to the White House 2008. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Wayne. Explain how these contests today, for the Democrats in particular, could mean no person in a clear lead. What does it mean to split the delegates rather than winner take all?
Well, what it means is that the Democrats allocate delegates proportional to the vote that the candidates receive in 75% of the delegates in any particular state are allocated in districts no larger than a congressional district. So that means if you have a district, for example, that's primarily African-American, Obama will win that. And if you have another district, which is a blue-collar district where Mrs. Clinton gets the greatest support, she'd win that. And both of them would probably not win it overwhelmingly, so they would split the delegates. It's going to be very, very close.
And how is it for the Republicans?
Well, the Republicans are different. A number of the large Republican states, New York, New Jersey, California, Missouri, have a winner-take-all vote. And that is, in New York and New Jersey, it's whoever gets the most votes within the state gets all the delegates, while in California, it's winner-take-all by congressional district, most of the delegates. So that gives McCain an advantage since he has a presumably the momentum going for him. The other interesting thing about many of the contests today is that these are what we call closed primaries. Only registered members of the party can participate, and that hurts both McCain and Obama, who have gotten a substantial portion of their vote from independents.
What happens to Edwards delegates?
Well, that depends on what Edwards says. Edwards has dropped out. Now, Edwards could, in the end, endorse someone, and I think he's probably waiting for someone to get into the lead and then endorse them and ask his delegates to vote for that person. If he says nothing, the delegates can come in and vote their own conscience. And even if Edwards says, I support Barack Obama or I support Hillary Clinton, that doesn't mean he can force his delegates to vote for Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. These are people who he's picked. So presumably they're loyal to him and to his ideas, but he can't command them to vote for any one person.
Professor Wayne, what's a superdelegate?
A superdelegate, only the Democrats have superdelegates. And superdelegates are people who are delegates by virtue of their position in elective or party office. There are three members of the national committee in each state. They're automatically delegates. All the members of Congress, the Democrats, are delegates. Ex-presidential candidates of the Democrats are delegates. Governors are delegates. Mayors of large cities can be delegates. And the thing about these delegates, they're not elected. They're simply appointed, and they're unpledged. So formally, they can vote for whomever they want. There has been a campaign, a subterranean campaign, between Obama and Mrs. Clinton to win the hearts and souls of these delegates. And in fact, that campaign began 2 years ago when both candidates, Mrs. Clinton and Obama, set up what were called leadership political action committees, which raised money and then distributed a substantial portion of this money to Democrats who were running for office.
We're talking to Professor Stephen Wayne. He teaches government at Georgetown University. Professor Wayne, what is the significance of so many states? I mean, this being the largest single day in the history of this country for voting in primaries?
Well, the significance of this is twofold. One, there has been a debate over the years among political scientists and some party officials about whether it would be fairer to have a national primary. And this is really the first test of what a national primary might look like. Incidentally, the states have been opposing this, and the party leadership opposes this, so it's something that just sort of happened by chance. The second significance of this is that it resembles how you campaign for the general election, in that you can't campaign in 24 states and go to coffee houses and sit in living rooms like you did in Iowa, New Hampshire, or to some extent South Carolina and Nevada. You really have to campaign by the media. To campaign with the media is very, very expensive, and it gives candidates with big war chests who've raised a lot of money and who are well known a tremendous advantage.
And what about Michigan and Florida for the Democrats? The fact that they buck the National Democratic Party, put their primaries ahead, and the Democratic Party says now they don't get delegates.
Well, incidentally, they've been penalized, these states, by the Republican Party as well, and their delegations have been cut in half by the Republican Party. My guess is that one of two things could happen. Either one, if Mrs. Clinton or Barack Obama gets a lead and goes into the convention with a plurality of the votes, in the interest of party unity, they'll vote to seat the entire delegation, which are the people who were chosen, because it won't matter. If it did matter and we went into the convention without a candidate having a lead, there would be a fight over the credentials of those delegates, somewhat like the fight we had in 1952 between Eisenhower delegates and Taft delegates at the Republican convention. And the convention would have to decide then whether to overturn the Democratic Party's National Committee rule and seat the delegates or not seat them. Now, these states can still be seated at the convention if they conduct a caucus which accords with Democratic rules. So they could, in fact, in June, conduct a caucus, maybe even elect the same delegates, and they would be in accord with the party rules. But they're not going to, the Democrats say, we'll not see delegates who are selected in a method or on a schedule that violates the party's rules.
Professor Wayne, if there is no clear Democratic winner today, what state becomes most important after this day of primaries and caucuses?
Well, that's very, very hard to say. Next week, you're going to have the District of Columbia, Virginia, and Maryland voting, and in subsequent weeks, big states such as Texas and Pennsylvania will be voting, and the most important states are the ones with the most delegates at stake, because up till this point, the name of the game was who got the most votes. At this point, the name of the game changes to who has the most delegates, and that should be what the media report on tonight. Don't worry about who wins and who loses. The candidates have enough of a national reputation. Look at the delegate count to see who's ahead and by how much.
And in Nevada, for example, the fact that was it Obama who won more delegates, but they say Hillary Clinton actually won?
Well, Hillary Clinton got more votes, but Obama got more delegates, and the Obama people are very angry that the press emphasized the popular vote victory when, in fact, they were competing for delegates. But, you know, the press emphasizes what the press wants to emphasize, and one of the areas that the press always emphasizes is the horse race. And believe it or not, we're going to have two Super Bowls the same week.
And finally, the national popular vote movement, can you explain that?
There are a lot of people who get upset that we don't elect our president by a direct popular vote, but by an indirect popular vote aggregated by states, in most cases on a winner-take-all system. So there have been proposals, which were renewed again after George W. Bush's victory, even though he didn't have the most popular votes in 2000. Now, in order to change the Electoral College, you have to amend the Constitution. There are some states who feel that the winner-take-all system or the fact that they have three electoral votes because they have two senators, even though they're a very small state, gives them an advantage. So there doesn't seem to be enough votes out there to get two-thirds of Congress and three-fourths of the states to amend the Constitution. So what is going on now is a deal, an interstate compact, where state legislatures would pass a law that says when a majority of the states buy into this compact, we will force our electors to vote for the national popular choice winner as opposed to the state popular choice winner. Two state legislatures, California and Maryland, passed this law, but Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed it. So only one state thus far has agreed to the compact. And until a majority of the states with electoral votes agree to it, it will not go into effect.
Though I said finally, here's my finally. What about the voting machines around this country that are supposedly tabulating the vote today?
Well, you know, we've always had problems with machines, and we've had problems with counting paper ballots. There seems to be a lot of nervousness about the machines where you touch the face of the machine to record your vote. Some states are now requiring what they call a paper trail. So if it looks like the machine count differs from what they expect the popular count to differ for, they would be able to check it by looking at the ballots. The Debo company, which makes these machines, has said that the machines are accurate and work well. The state of California says they have not been, and Maryland, too. So this is one of those open questions, and I suspect in some cases the loser will point to the machines and say the machines did it, not me.
Professor Stephen Wayne, I want to thank you for being with us. Teaches government at Georgetown University. His book is called The Road to the White House 2008. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by New York Times investigative journalist Philip Sheenan. His new book has come out today, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. Stay with us.
Thank you.
democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 650 stations, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take, as over 150 are, and also in transcript form. I'm Amy Goodman. The executive director of the Federal 9/11 Commission, Philip Zelikow, had much closer ties to the Bush administration than publicly disclosed. This is according to an explosive new book by New York Times investigative reporter Philip Sheenan. It's called The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. The book goes on sale today, but has already created quite a stir in Washington. Philip Sheenan alleges Zelikow had close ties to both Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and political adviser Karl Rove, suggesting he sought to minimize the Bush administration's responsibility for failing to prevent the September 11th attacks. New York Times investigative reporter and author Philip Sheenan joins us now here in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
In joining us in Washington, D.C. Can you start off beginning where you began in your book, with the story of Sandy Berger?
Well, in 2002, Sandy Berger, on behalf of President Clinton, was asked to go to the National Archives to begin reviewing the Clinton administration's most secret national security papers to prepare for all the investigations that everyone assumed were coming on 9/11. And it appears that in his very early travels to the National Archives, he began stealing documents. He began stealing, in particular, one document that had been prepared in 2001. Many of his friends and admirers believe that he stole this document because he believed wrongly that he was somehow, or he and the Clinton administration were somehow going to be scapegoated for 9/11.
Talk about what he took, what he stuffed into his socks and pockets, and how he was discovered.
He kept stealing the same document. It was a report prepared by Richard Clark, who you'll recall at the time was the president's counterterrorism czar. He served that function both in the Clinton and in the Bush administrations. Berger had tasked him after a series of terrorist threats at the time of the millennium to prepare a long list of recommendations for how the nation should better prepare itself for terrorist threats. Clark did as he was asked to and prepared a very long list, apparently 29 pages, or rather 29 recommendations. Berger may have believed, or at least people who know about the investigation believe, that he thought that because some of these recommendations had not been acted on by the time the Clinton administration left office, that somehow he, Berger, and President Clinton would be blamed for having left the nation vulnerable on 9/11. And again, over a period of more than a year, during several visits to the National Archives, whenever Berger finds this document, he steals it. There are several copies of it he steals.
And what happened to him?
The archive staff became alarmed early on in one of the early visits that something was wrong. Berger kept making frequent trips to the men's room, seemingly that were unnecessary. One staffer sees him in the hallway with what appears to be papers rolled around his socks. The archive staff figures they've got to sort of test Berger, and they begin numbering the documents. They begin with a pencil. They place numbers on the back of all the documents that are given to Berger, and on a later visit, they determine that indeed their documents missing. They can determine pretty quickly. They call in they let the White House know that this is happening. The White House lets the Justice Department know that this is happening, and Berger finds himself the subject of a criminal investigation quickly.
Let's talk about Philip Zelikow, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. First, tell us how it was formed, and then his control of the commission.
The commission was formed by a law passed in Congress in 2002 after long and very tortured debate. It was a 10-member panel, five Democrats, five Republicans. The only person for the commission chosen by the White House was the chairman, initially Henry Kissinger. Kissinger stepped down, and he was replaced by Tom Kaine, the governor of New Jersey. Democratic leaders in the House and Senate chose their five representatives. early on, after Governor Kaine came on board, there was a search for an executive director, somebody to run the investigation on a day-to-day basis. There's a polite fiction in Washington that the reports of blue ribbon commissions are written by the blue ribbon commissioners. Well, that's not usually the case. They're usually written by a professional staff led by a congressional researcher or a scholar. In this case, Kaine and Hamilton came across the resume quite early on of Philip Zelikow, a very well-respected historian at the University of Virginia. They contact him, and Zelikow agrees to come on board.
And he had served on the Blue Ribbon Commission investigating the 2000 vote that got Bush selected.
Exactly, and he had earned the praise of both Republicans and Democrats on that commission. It's one of the commissioners from the Electoral Reform Commission who joins the 9/11 Commission and forwards Zelikow's name to Kaine and Hamilton. And as I say, Zelikow comes on board quite early.
You talk about in your book the commission that's just being released this week, just being released today, Zelikow's secret relationship with Karl Rove. He's this week becoming a commentator on Fox News, but much more relevant was his top status within the White House, top advisor to President Bush.
Well, what I can tell you is that in 2003, Karl Rove called Zelikow a number of times at the commission. We know this because there are phone logs recording Rove's calls in. Now, Zelikow had a lot of ties to the Bush administration, and that was known to some degree when he signed on to the investigation. And he had assured the commission that he would do his best to avoid the appearance of a conflict of interest and would cut off most of these ties with his friends in the White House and elsewhere. It becomes known on the commission staff in 2003 that despite these promises, Zelikow was having conversations with, of all people, Karl Rove. And this creates, as you might imagine, a huge amount of alarm and suspicion on the commission staff. You know, what is the executive director of the 9/11 commission doing talking to Karl Rove? Now, Rove's people at the White House, you know, his friends and allies there, and Zelikow insist that that this was completely innocent and that this involved Zelikow's work at the University of Virginia. And indeed, Zelikow's work at the University of Virginia centered around presidential histories. So Karl Rove is somebody he would have normally at the university had some sort of contact with, I assume. And there's a odd development thereafter, which is Zelikow calls in his secretary, shuts the door, and informs her that she is no longer to keep phone logs of his contacts with the White House. The secretary is alarmed by this, worries that she's being asked to do something improper, and then contacts the chief lawyer for the commission to alert him to what's happened. As I say, this whole sequence creates a great alarm and a great suspicion about what Zelikow was up to.
We're talking to Philip Sheehan. His book has just come out. It's called The Commission. His relationship, Philip Zelikow's relationship with Condoleezza Rice, how far back does it go, and what does it mean for the ultimate report that comes out?
Well, they have a relationship that goes way back. They were both members of the National Security Council staff in the first Bush administration, Bush 41. They formed a close friendship at that point. After that presidency, Zelikow goes off to Harvard and Rice returns to Stanford, yet they stay in touch and they write a book together about German reunification. After President Bush, the 43, enters the White House. He sets up a transition team for the National Security Council at Rice's recommendation, and Rice tasks Zelikow to join the transition team, specifically with responsibility for reviewing counterterrorism operations at the White House. Now, some of this was known at the time of Zelikow's hiring. I think the question is how much of that was known. And, of course, Rice was at the heart of the 9/11 Commission investigation. You know, it was her actions in the spring and summer of 2001 that were among the most important subjects for investigation by the 9/11 Commission, yet the commission was being run on a day-to-day basis by somebody who was undeniably a very close friend of hers.
I want to go to National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice publicly testifying before the 9/11 Commission. It was April 8, 2004, an exchange between Rice and Commissioner Richard Benveniste.
You acknowledged to us in your interview of February 7, 2004, that Richard Clark told you that Al-Qaeda cells were in the United States. Did you tell the president at any time prior to August 6 of the existence of Al-Qaeda cells in the United States?
First, let me just make certain.
If you could just answer that question,
first,
because I only have a very limited.
I understand, Commissioner, but it's also important, Commissioner, that I address the other issues that you have raised. So I will do it quickly, but if you'll just give me a moment.
Well, my only question to you is whether you
I understand,
told
Commissioner,
the president.
But if you'll just give me a moment, I will address fully the questions that you've asked. First of all, yes, the August 6th PDB was in response to questions of the president. In that sense, he asked that this be done. It was not a particular threat report. And there was historical information in there about various aspects of Al-Qaeda's operations. Dick Clark had told me, I think in a memorandum, I remember it as being only a line or two, that there were Al-Qaeda cells in the United States. Now, the question is, what did we need to do about that? And I also understood that that was what the FBI was doing, that the FBI was pursuing these Al-Qaeda cells. I believe in the August 6th memorandum, it says that there were 70 full field investigations underway of these cells. And so there was no recommendation that we do something about this. The FBI was pursuing it. I really don't remember, Commissioner, whether I discussed this with the president.
I remember
very well that the president was aware that there were issues inside the United States. He talked to people about this. But I don't remember the Al-Qaeda cells as being something that we were told we needed to do something about.
Isn't it a fact, Dr. Rice, that the August 6 PDB warned against possible attacks in this country? And I ask you whether you recall the title of that PDB.
I believe the title was Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States.
Condoleezza Rice being questioned by Richard Benveniste of the 9/11 Commission. The significance of this interchange, Philip Sheehan.
Well, those were probably the five most dramatic moments in the 2 years I covered the commission. Well, there was a rather remarkable document that was handed to President Bush in August 2001, titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. It was his—it's the daily brief. The president receives sort of a super-secret newspaper every morning that has the most important news the CIA wants to get across to him. And that was the headline on the PDB on August 6, 2001, just, you know, a month before 9/11. And the question is why, after the president and Rice got this document, they didn't do much more to try to prepare for the possibility of a domestic terrorist strike. Now, I will tell you, the August 6 PDB, you can make too much of it and you can make too little of it. A lot of the information in the PDB was wrong. A lot of it was historical, that dated back several years. But there were some fairly specific current warnings, current intelligence suggesting that something was going on. And it actually refers to concerns that terrorists might be conducting surveillance of the skyline of New York City and that hijacked planes might somehow be involved in whatever threat was underway.
And what ultimately got reported in the commission report of Condoleezza Rice, what she knew, when she knew it. What effect did Philip Zelikow have on that?
Well, Zelikow apparently used the term Clark-centric. He kept telling the staff that he thought the report that they were writing was too Clark-centric, too much drawn from and defending the position of Richard Clark, who had argued, you know, rather explosively in 2004 that President Bush and Condi Rice had ignored his warnings that something terrible was about to happen.
How did the Bush administration try to destroy Richard Clark's credibility?
Well, they had quite a campaign going both publicly and behind the scenes to lead the public to believe that Richard Clark was making these damning allegations, either because he was a very partisan Democrat who wanted to see President Bush ousted from the White House in the elections that November. And they also engaged in a behind-the-scenes attack to feed questions to the 9/11 Commission that they thought would undermine Clark's credibility.
We're talking to Philip Sheehan, investigative reporter. His book is called The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. We'll be back with him in a minute. DemocracyNow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest today is Philip Sheehan. He has just published his book, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. Philip, I wanted to play for you the vice chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, denying claims that Zelikow worked to minimize the Bush administration's responsibility for failing to prevent the 9/11 attacks.
We found him to be very fair-minded, quite impartial, very rigorous in his searching out of the facts, and he certainly did not try to protect the Bush administration or to protect anybody else.
That was the 9/11 Commission Vice Chair Lee Hamilton, interviewed on NBC's Nightly News. Philip Sheehan.
Congressman Hamilton has always, throughout the investigation, was a big champion of Dr. Zelikow's. Mr. Hamilton was very much involved in the decision to hire Dr. Zelikow in the first place. I will tell you that I think there are a large number of people on the commission staff, at least, who would certainly disagree with Congressman Hamilton.
In your book, Philip Sheehan, you write about Attorney General Ashcroft and how he tried to mount an attack on a member of the commission to defer criticism that he refused to listen to reports about al-Qaeda threats.
Well, I will that attack, it's a bit of an irony that John Ashcroft, who was treated very harshly by the 9/11 Commission in his appraisal of his performance, was really the man who maybe more than anyone else is responsible for the unanimity of the 9/11 Commission at the end. The commission was prepared to make very serious charges against Ashcroft, that he had essentially ignored terrorist threats in the spring and summer of 2001, that he had actually told the FBI that he didn't want to hear anything more about al-Qaeda. He didn't feel he could do anything about it. The FBI was pretty—was astounded by that declaration from Ashcroft. But Ashcroft's strategy then was to mount a counterattack, and he mounted a counterattack against Jamie Gorelick, one of the Democratic commissioners on the commission, who had been deputy attorney general in the Clinton administration. And Ashcroft made public some memos from the Clinton administration that he said showed that Gorelick was responsible for so many of the problems that the FBI and the Justice Department faced in 2001 in not being able to respond to terrorist attacks. The commissioners, to a person, found Ashcroft's attack to be wildly unfair, and really rallied behind Gorelick. And really, as I say, Ashcroft's attack is really what brought the commissioners together at the end to produce a unanimous report.
And what about Max Cleland, the senator from Georgia, who served on the commission? What happened to him?
he was, you know, easily the most partisan Democrat on the commission. He believed that the 9/11 commission needed to get to the bottom of why so many people in the Bush administration appear to have bungled intelligence in the spring and summer of 2001. And perhaps more importantly for Cleland, he thought the commission needed to try to figure out if the Bush administration had taken the nation to war in 2003 in Iraq on the basis of faulty intelligence, that it had sort of rigged the case against Iraq, trying to link it to al-Qaeda. The commission very much, the commission's leadership very much didn't want to take on those issues, and they became so alarmed by Cleland's outbursts and his obvious disdain for President Bush and for Karl Rove in particular, that they looked for a way to ease him off the investigation, and they were successful at that. Cleland was offered a job elsewhere in the federal government and left the panel. Now, Cleland will tell you that it was his decision, absolutely, to get off the commission. He thought it was on the verge of a whitewash, and he wanted off. But regardless, he leaves the scene, and former Nebraska Senator Bob Kerry joins the commission in his place.
What about the vice president, Dick Cheney, then and now?
Well, he plays a big role in much of this story. Cheney was really at the forefront of efforts to try to stop the 9/11 commission from being created in the first place. He was unsuccessful at that, obviously. He becomes important later on when the commission begins to investigate what happened at the White House on the morning of September 11th. Most importantly, the question with regards to Cheney was, why did he authorize the Pentagon on the morning of 9/11 to begin shooting down passenger planes if they approached Washington, D.C.? Cheney was at the White House. The president was in Florida. Cheney, claiming he was acting at the authorization of the president, told the Pentagon to be prepared to shoot down passenger planes, and he insisted, he being the vice president, insisted to the 9/11 commission that he had only issued this order after consultation with the president and after receiving the president's approval. The commission staff, and I think most of the commissioners, become convinced over time that that account is just not true, that the vice president issued the shoot-down order without any authorization from the president, an act that would almost certainly be unconstitutional. The vice president really has no role in military decision-making. If there was a shoot-down order issued, it should have been issued either by the president or by the defense secretary in his place. The commission, if you read between the lines of the 9/11 commission report, I think you can see that they didn't believe the vice president.
We're talking to Philip Sheenan, investigative reporter with the New York Times, has just come out with the book, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. It comes from his years of reporting on the commission as well as the aftermath. Can you talk about where Bob Kerry stood, who replaced Max Cleland? The reports are that he almost quit when he heard about Zelikow's connections to Karl Rove and Condoleezza Rice.
Kerry joins the commission in December of 2003. There are really only several months left in the investigation at that point. He cancels his Christmas vacation with his wife in Italy, and he gets on the train and comes down to Washington and begins reading up on what's in the commission's files. And on the very first day he begins going through the files, he comes across a memo that Zelikow had apparently prepared listing all of his ties to the Bush administration, his friendship with Condi Rice, his involvement on the transition team, the fact that he had written the 2002 preemptive war strategy for the White House that would be used to justify the Iraq war in 2003.
Explain that.
We have to backtrack a bit, but
right.
In 2002, this is before the creation of the 9/11 Commission, Condoleezza Rice contacts Zelikow at the University of Virginia and asks him to prepare a document for the White House that would justify a preemptive war, an attack against an enemy that did not necessarily pose an immediate threat to the United States. In many ways, it would be a document that would turn American military doctrine on its head. Zellico does this and produces quite a masterfully written a memo that's called the National Security Strategy of the United States, issued in September in 2002. And very few people know that this document was written by Philip Zellico of the University of Virginia. That really wouldn't be well known for another 2 years. Now, bringing the story forward a bit, Bob Kerry comes across the memo listing all of Zellico's ties to the White House and his contacts and his friendships, and announces immediately to Tom Kaine, the chairman of the commission, that it's either him or me. Zellico goes or I go. How could you possibly have hired somebody with so many conflicts of interest to run this investigation?
President Bush, talk about the unique circumstances under which President Bush and Vice President Cheney testified before the commission.
Well, for most of the life of the 9/11 commission, the president and the vice president had no intention of meeting with the 9/11 commission. They argued that it was not the president's place to be involved in that sort of questioning. And there was some history there. The President Lyndon Johnson had refused to answer questions from the Warren Commission, at least face-to-face. At the end of the day, political pressures were such that the president and the vice president, Bush and Cheney, agreed to meet with all 10 members of the 9/11 commission. They would only meet with the commissioners if they could appear together. The questioning could not be under oath, and it could not be recorded in any way. And it took place in the spring of 2004, just a couple of months before the commission finished its work.
Wasn't the most astounding part of that it wasn't under oath?
Well, as I say, there's no history of presidents being required to submit to questioning like this. And you know, the White House had a strong argument in many ways. President Johnson was not required to submit to similar questioning, and certainly not under oath, before the Warren Commission that was investigating the assassination of his predecessor.
Let me ask you about those in this country who believe 9/11 was an inside job. How did you deal with that, Philip Sheehan, and the fact, for example, the concerns among many others that the building number 7 was not even talked about in the commission report?
It's a tough issue. I just haven't seen the evidence. I mean, there's certainly people who believe it was an inside job. I have trouble believing that myself. I have great difficulty believing in vast conspiracies. I just think a conspiracy of that nature would require competence on the part of people in the federal government that I just don't believe exists in the federal government.
The Jersey Girls, their role in all of this. Who they were, the significance and the formation and the conclusions and their attitude afterwards to what ultimately came out.
Well, this commission would never, never have been formed without the pressure of the 9/11 families. You know, there was great resistance from the White House. There was great resistance from Republican leaders in Congress to having any sort of investigation, certainly no independent investigation of 9/11.
McCain did push for it, didn't he?
Oh, McCain was absolutely a champion of this, and I think second only to the families of Senator John McCain in getting the commission created. The Jersey Girls were a particularly aggressive and effective group of the 9/11 survivors to really shame the White House and Congress into creating the 9/11 commission. And they were very aggressive throughout the investigation in trying to keep the investigation on course. And they were very harshly critical of Zellico. And they were among the first to sort of go public with information about Zellico's ties to the White House. They very early on called for Zellico to resign or to severely recuse himself from involvement in the investigation.
Sybelle Edmonds, the translator, interpreter, who was hired soon after 9/11. She ultimately did get a private hearing with the commission. The significance of her testimony, was it considered at all?
I know they heard from her. I don't get the impression they may have taken her as seriously as they perhaps should have, but though they don't address her in any way, they don't address her in any serious way in the commission's final report.
the CIA, George Tenet?
The CIA, it's interesting about the CIA because I do think the commission staff found there were an awful lot of people at the CIA to admire. There were people at the CIA who really understood the bin Laden threat early on and really wanted to see action taken to try to shut down the al-Qaeda network. And Tenet, to his credit, was one of the people who early on does seem to have understood al-Qaeda and was warning, the White House was warning Congress that they needed to do more to prepare. Tenet becomes a very controversial figure on the commission, among the commissioners, on the commission staff, because of the concern that he may not have always been telling the truth. They were so concerned about his truthfulness, in fact, that when they held private interviews with Tenet, he, unlike most other witnesses, was required to be placed under oath. They were so concerned about his credibility. Now, I'll tell you that Tenet's loyalists at the CIA say this is grossly unfair, that there was an effort by the commission, and Zelikow in particular, to scapegoat the CIA, and that the commission built an unfair case against Tenet, that his memory was really no more faulty than anyone else's. But the commission staff says that Tenet couldn't recall very important documents, couldn't recall very important meetings, couldn't recall very important events in the course of the months before 9/11 that he should easily have been able to recall.
Why did the commission fail to expose Rudolph Giuliani and his role in the lead-up to 9/11 in preventing the attack? In fact, today is a primary day in New York. September 11, 2001 was another day that the polls were open. Philip Sheehan.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, the commission staff, I guess I should, the commission staff always qualifies this. They say that Rudy Giuliani, on the day of September 11th, performed heroically. You know, he really comforted the city and the nation in a way that certainly the president of the United States wasn't able to. But what happened during the 8 years before that? You know, New York City had been attacked in 1993 by Islamic extremists. And what did they attack? They attacked the World Trade Center. And nobody should have been surprised that the terrorists would return someday and that the World Trade Center might well remain one of their principal targets. During those 8 years, the commission staff found the Giuliani administration had done remarkably little to prepare the city for the possibility of a terrorist strike. And the commission staff drew together a long, long list of questions, tough questions, to be asked of Giuliani when he finally testified before the 9/11 commission in May of 2004. But the commissioners will acknowledge—
We have 10 seconds.
Oh, I'm sorry. The commissioners, at the end of the day, were frightened of Giuliani and really only asked him softballs.
Hmm. Well, Philip Sheehan, we have to leave it there. You certainly don't leave it there in your book. The book is called The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Hilda Kadusar, Mata Angeli Kam, Jeffrey Hagerman. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website, democracynow.org. We're looking for a TV producer full-time here in New York. Check our website. Thanks for joining us.